Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Jill Cement was 16 when she signed up for a life drawing class. As she handed over a check she wrote herself, she was excited by the prospect of being taken seriously, by getting to pursue her art, join a class with other adults, draw nude models. The class was taught by American artist, 47-year-old Arnold Meshes. On the final night of class, Jill waited in the hallway until all the other students left. She returned to the classroom, walked up to Arnold, and kissed him. That's the story Jill told the world 30 years ago in her first memoir, Half a Life. Today, she re-examines those scenes for a new book, Consent, saying that Arnold was the one who initiated that first kiss. He was the first to say he wished she was older. Consent unravels her marriage after Arnold's death, creating an unflinching portrait of a woman who seems to still be debating whether the way her marriage began should stain the life she built. Joining me today is the author of Consent, Jill Cement. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start where your memoir starts, the moment the relationship between you and Arnold began. As I said, your first memoir, Half a Life, you wrote that you were the one who kissed him. But in Consent, you re-examined that story, saying he was the one who kissed you. I've heard you in other interviews say both of those stories were true when you wrote them. And I'm wondering if you can explain why that is.
Because first, you know, it's a memory. And a memory is a very vague and, you know, elusive thing. When I wrote Half a Life, I was trying to show the story of a young woman who wanted to empower herself. And so when I remembered the kiss, I remembered myself as the aggressor. But when I look back at it many years later, you know, I realized that wasn't exactly true, that, you know, I believed that he had pulled me towards him. I mean, he had pulled me towards him. It's not that they're both true. I mean, he shouldn't have done what he did, okay? And had he not done that, maybe I wouldn't have become the aggressor, because I know I'm the first person who seduced him. I know I returned from New York at 17, went to his studio and seduced him. Would I have done that had he not kissed me first? Probably not. So in a certain way, him kissing me is the beginning of what would be considered today an illicit relationship. But in those days, it was acceptable. That's the only way I can put it.
Yeah, I want to talk about context quite a bit in the coming hour. But you revisit this after Arnold passes away and after the Me Too movement. Was there anything about that that gave you a different lens on your situation?
Well, you know, the Me Too movement awakened so many women my age, because there is not a woman my age who doesn't have a Me Too movement, a moment. I mean, it's just every woman I know I'm in my 70s, who experienced the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, had some memory of being aggressively gone after by a man of power. So, you know, in seeing that as a new way of looking at the world, because again, it wasn't how we look at the world then. You know, I started to really think about what he had done. And, you know, I was a professor. I'm a professor emeritus now. And we fill out these sexual harassment questionnaires every year. And they tell you, Joe comes into the room and you read this thing and then you write whose behavior is wrong. And, you know, I started to imagine if somebody had written what Arnold had done. And I could see that it would not have passed a test. It would have been considered sexual harassment. And so I started to go back and I started to rethink about my life within this context. It doesn't mean that this context is the only context, because there was another context in 1970. And that context said, if you kissed your art teacher, you were the coolest girl around. You were aggressive, you were brave, you were trying for a bigger life. So, it's hard to reconcile two very different moments of history that you've lived through.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that in terms of your first memoir, Half a Life. It was published in 1996, and I will say this was when I was entering high school. And this is the after the Anita Hill hearings, but just before the Monica Lewinsky became a household name. And I think a lot about that moment. I've been thinking a lot about that moment because I can remember how the Monica Lewinsky affair was portrayed. It was a relationship between two adults. Lewinsky was 22, so she was an adult by any standard, but she was an intern being pursued by the 49-year-old leader of the free world. And just that context around her and whether she could have consented fully to that relationship, I don't even think the word consent was in my vocabulary at that time.
No, the Lewinsky thing, I mean, obviously people laughed. Okay, it was, to have caught the president in, with the cigar and the blue dress, it was an extraordinary moment in history. But my heart breaks for Monica Lewinsky because she was really,
She was dragged through the press.
she was called a bimbo and somebody, the aggressor. And here's the thing, I hate the idea that young women who have their own sexual demands and their own desires to be powerful are always seen as the victim. I think Monica Lewinsky wasn't the victim so much of her in her sexual relationship with Clinton, but the victim of press, because I mean, I'm sure she wanted it. Okay. I mean, maybe he was manipulating her, but all men manipulate. I'm sure she was, she seems to be a really intelligent, brave person. And maybe in her own mind, she probably was completely consenting. Listen, it's so different. The idea of consent for someone who ended up in the lair of Harvey Weinstein is quite different than what I experienced or what Monica Lewinsky experienced.
I think we always want these things to be so black and white, to be good or
They're
evil,
not.
right or wrong. And that's what makes this book, it's going to be one of those books that haunt me for a long time.
I had such a happy marriage and such an and a marriage of incredible equality, okay, for the whole thing. I saw myself as a young woman who really went out and got what I wanted. I was a lot braver then than I am now. I had the blindness of youth. And so to write about myself as a victim seemed much more of a lie than to write about myself as an empowered young woman.
But looking back on that young woman, you said you've been a professor, you've taught students. If you saw, if you as an adult now witnessed this kind of pursuit by a teacher of a student, would you intervene?
First of all, I have seen that numerous times, and numerous times I've intervened. But the way I've intervened is by talking to the student before I talk to the other professor. If this, I mean, again, it's so different today. In consent, I also describe my college years. And in my college years in consent, I would say at least a quarter of the professors at CalArts when I was there were sleeping with students. So it was a permissible thing. In many ways, it was despicable because I don't think every student that was being sought by professors was really capable of making those decisions. I think it is abominable to sleep with your students as a professor, and I now know why. But it was done in 1970, and people thought of it as part of the educational experience. I mean, suddenly you were sleeping with someone who knew so much more than you, and it was information you wanted. And it was another way of getting it. You know, there used to be in Indonesia years ago when the Dutch were the colonialists, they used to have women that were called something language. I don't remember the name, but it was like somebody who taught them the language, but they always did it through sex because that's when people become intimate and learn the language. And I think women my age, when they were involved in a relationship like that, where they had the power to make that decision, also saw it as a moment to have the power themselves. Maybe it's a mistake, maybe it was foolish, but that was what people believed.
Yeah, I think, I mean, even if you look back to the culture of the mid to late 90s when your first memoir is coming out, this is a cultural touchstone for me. The very popular show Dawson's Creek launched in, I believe, January of 1998. And the storyline, one of the big storylines of the early seasons was this young man named Pacey who has a sexual affair with his teacher. She's, I think, 35, 36. He's 15. And it was, I mean, it was portrayed as taboo, right? As they could get in trouble, she could get in all kinds of trouble. But it was also romanticized. And it is so wild to me now, as an adult, as a 40-year-old woman, to think I was swooning over this relationship as a 15-year-old because of the way it was portrayed to me by this incredibly popular TV show. It was like the number one show for teens at a certain point.
You know, I was talking to Lauren Groff, the writer, and she had written an essay about Lolita and reading it at 13, the same age Lolita was when Humbert Humper was going after her. And she said it informed her entire sexual being at that age because she suddenly realized that little girls her age, and she said she was a very, like, she lived a very regular teenage life, something I did not have. And she said it informed her idea of the power that young girls could have. So it's alluring, and it would be a lie to pretend it isn't alluring. And so because it is alluring, it is the older partner who should put the brakes on. I didn't see Dawson Creek. Maybe I should look it up now.
Yeah, it's so strange to look back on it contextually, to have a romanticized relationship with the teacher. Later on, you know, for women younger than me, there was this television show called Pretty Little Liars, where one of the young high school students has an affair. She's a female who has a affair with her teacher. They fall in love. By the end of the series, they get married. And it continues to persist in culture as this romanticized relationship, probably right up until the Me Too movement.
Well, you know, every single major writer that I admired in, and there were very few women writers. Of course, I admired many, like, you know, I can name many, but most of the books that came out during my time were, let's say, Philip Roth, any of the men, okay? Or any of the movies, like Bertolucci's, what is it, that famous movie of Bertolucci where the older with Marlon Brando, forgotten the name of the movie. Anyhow, it was always about an older man pursuing a younger girl. That was like the trope of almost every novel that came out. Nobody said anything. And one of the things that I really wanted to do as a young writer was to write against that trope, was to tell the story from the young girl's point of view. And I felt like, you know, I had that insight that these men didn't have. And, you know, many of my books are about that, about young girls going after older men. And I was putting it into the context of literature because, again, that was the main story of my life. And obviously of yours too, from TV.
Yeah, you think about the culture in which you were steeped as a kid and how that impacts the arc of your life. I do want to ask, the consent feels almost like an autopsy of half a life. And I found it so intriguing to think of a writer picking apart their own work so publicly. What inspired you to do this?
Well, you know, I mean, again, the Me Too movement started, and I started to think about my relationship with Arnold. And I sat down just to write a short essay about it. And, I hadn't read Half a Life. I never read my old work, and I still haven't read Half a Life. I only read the parts about Arnold because
Oh my goodness.
it's unbearable. Okay. It's
I
like
know that
looking at
feeling.
high school yearbook pictures. Okay. It's just horrifying. And, I read those pages and I thought, wow, I told half a story. And so I started to go through those pages and to analyze them, mostly not for what I put in, but for what I left out. Remember, in fiction, when you omit a scene, it's because it's a failure of imagination. You could have thought of the scene, but you didn't. When you omit a scene in memoir, it has a psychological connotation. And so I started to go through and look at all the different things that I omitted. And that was how I started the book.
My producer says that movie you were looking for might be Last Tango in Paris.
Last Tango in Paris. There it is. Perfect. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to explore how memories are captured into memoirs. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
WOSU's Politics and a Pint is back, and we certainly have a lot to talk about. Join me, Mike Thompson, All Sides host Anna Staver, and a panel of reporters to discuss this incredible 2024 campaign and wash down that political talk with a pint or two. It's Thursday, August 15th at 6 at 7th Sun Brewing in Italian Village. Go to wosu.org/events to register.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. In her first memoir, Half a Life, Jill Cement explored her relationship with her husband, Arnold. But she took out certain details, changed settings, and perhaps put a soft filter over her memories. In her new memoir, Consent, she strips back those moments, telling the world her story through a perhaps more critical lens. Jill Cement is still with us this hour, and I want to talk about how you describe memories. You say memoirs are closer to historical fiction than to biography. You even call moments scenes rather than memories. I find that such a fascinating concept. And, when I think of my own memories, even when you have, and conversations you have with old friends, right? You're trying to remember
Right.
something from high school, and you two have such a different version of what happened.
Well, even when you have a fight with your spouse the night before,
Oh my
and the person
goodness.
says, I said this, and you said, you didn't say that. I said that. And you go back and forth. So you can't really count on memory as being something that is solid. It's vapor. And so to write a memoir is to, I mean, my process, and maybe it's not even a memoir, maybe we should call it fiction. I mean, I have no idea.
Personal fiction.
Personal fiction. I mean, first there's the mythology that your family comes up with, and you see yourself in that mythology. Every family member has a role. And you take that role and you bring it into marriage, and that also makes for different memories. When I write, what I do is if I have a memory, it could be a vague memory, it can be something that is not quite solid, but I remember it. And as I start to create a story out of it, it leads me to another memory that seems solid. It's almost like going from stepping stone to stepping stone. And the fictional aspect of memoir is moving from one stone to the other. But maybe the stones themselves are also elusive. It's, you know, I'm sure that's the same way history is written. I mean, it's, we're living beings, time passes through us, and what we remember about that experience is vague and dreamlike, and language is hard and solid. And it's about trying to take that experience, that dreamlike experience, and put it into a narrative that another human being can follow. So I think that's what memoir really is.
Years ago, I heard about this scientific discovery that when we recall a memory, when we pull it into the front of our mind, we're actually rewriting it. So we're making copies of it over and over and over again. And it really made me think of that yeah, every time we pull it back to think about it, perhaps we're changing it in some way.
Absolutely. And who you are at the time that you remember it. I mean, had Arnold, for example, not left his wife, okay? And I had spent my first 10 years in one of these relationships where the man is married, promising to leave his wife, would I be telling the story the way I'm telling it now? I probably would have told it completely different. So what happens in our lives changes how we remember our lives.
You know, the passages from Half a Life have this almost outward look. There's a lot of sensory details, figurative language. Consent is very inward focused, looking at how you feel about these memories. I want to ask, like, from a technical perspective, how did your writing approach have to change to write such a different kind of memoir?
Well, first, my writing itself had changed. I mean, I
30 years is a lifetime.
I've written 10 books in the interim. What happens, I think, when you're young and you're writing, your brain is popping with metaphors and you are trying to create what you think of as beauty. Okay. And that's sort of what is your inspiration. It's what you think art should be. And for myself, again, I'm only speaking for myself. As I started to age as a writer, what became more interesting to me was precision, not beauty. Okay. I found beauty to start to lie in precision. And so the clearer my writing became, that was what I wanted. I wanted to go, I mean, when I was younger, I wanted to create a wild metaphor. And when I was older, I wanted to create a sentence that could not be interpreted any other way but the way I put it down. And so I think you're looking at not so much the stories changed, but the writer changed.
In some ways, it also mirrors for me some of the changes we've seen in fiction, particularly in genre fiction. You know, nowadays, first-person, present-tense narratives are very lucrative, very common. Pacing feels so much faster than traditional novel writing. In some ways, I think it's our cultural desire for perhaps this raw, straight, more straightforward storytelling.
But at the same time, present tense is a way, present tense is, let me put it this way, okay? Present tense is a way of not having reflection, because it's happening to you at that time. It's like if you walk into a bar, there's two ways to tell a story in first person. One way is to be the old mariner, and you sit down next to some old lady, and she says, yeah, you're not going to believe it. You look at me now, but this is not who I really am. And she tells you the story of who she really is. Another story in a bar is someone walks in, grabs you by the lapels, and says, you're not going to believe what just happened to me. And they're going to relay the story in what we would consider present tense. And those are the two ways in which stories in the first person can be told. When you're, you know, younger, okay, you don't have reflection. And if you look through Half a Life, there's a lot less reflection in it. But again, when you get older, it's about, writing becomes totally about reflection. And, you know, I think that that's why I think it's important to have writers of many ages. The first person present tense has an immediacy that grabs people, and the old voice of the Ancient Mariner has a voice that promises you wisdom.
I want to ask about how you construct scenes in this book, because the settings change from Half a Life to Consent. And what I mean by that is there are details about like pink walls and Barbie sheets or smoky atmospheres in Chinese restaurants. What kind of power do you think setting gives, not only in memoir, but in storytelling?
Well, setting is you know, crucially important, because when you describe the world, you're describing, it's not like you're describing the world with a camera. I mean, what art is someone sees the world and then it gets in their head and it gets jumbled along with their personality, their politics, everything. So when they describe something, not everybody sees the same thing. Like I used to always say to my students, try to describe the world when you really have to pee badly. You're going to look for a bathroom. You're going to look for a place, you know, you're going to think about the physical world differently than if you walk, you know, think about how much money you have in your pocket. If you walk out the door with $1 million in your pocket, you're going to see a different world than if you walk out the door with a penny in your pocket. So the subjective part of setting is what interests me.
How did you decide which stories to include in Consent? Because it is a short book. I believe it's under 150 pages, just under there. How did you choose what to include?
You know, I first of all, I wrote like 300-400 pages to get those pages. So it wasn't like some sort of like easy decision. I wrote lots of scenes that included a lot of people. But then when I realized what the book was truly about, I excluded those scenes so that it would have a tightness. I tried to put in a scene where we weren't getting along so that it wouldn't seem like this idyllic marriage. And the only scene I could remember is a huge fight we had about a printing list, okay? So I put that scene in. I wanted to put in a scene about how we collaborated. So, you know, I'd have a vague memory. Again, although the only scene that I'm sure is exact is that fight. That's the one that I'm pretty sure is exact. And, you know, I had the experience of taking someone to death, which is maybe the most extraordinary experience a human being can have. And I wanted to include those scenes. So I wanted to include scenes that define the marriage in its largest sense, but I wanted to condense them so that somebody could hold the story in their head, which is much harder to do when you have a 500-page story than when you have a 150-page story.
It's also much harder as somebody who, you know, has to winnow things down for a living. Before I became a radio host, I was a print journalist for 12 years. So deciding what not to keep can almost be as hard as deciding what to include.
Actually, it's harder. I mean, if you just were to like let yourself go and write, and not try to sculpt it, you know, you would have a diary. That's essentially, and that's what I wanted to avoid.
You also try to paint, I think, a complete picture of Arnold. You know, this time around you include that not only was he married with children at the time that you meet him, he had another mistress. That wasn't in the first memoir.
Well, I don't know why I didn't include it. You know, I was, the first memoir is about my whole childhood.
It's not just about your relationship, right?
Yeah. And Arnold doesn't come into it till the very end. Also, in those days, I didn't want to be quote unquote obvious. Like I thought it wasn't artistic if I were to mention that Arnold was the same age as my father and talk about the Oedipus complex. I thought, I would be being too obvious. There was something in youth, you're so worried. And I see it with my students. It's like they're so stingy with what they want to give the reader because they think that makes them sound more intelligent. Whereas if you really have something to say, you just say it. And so Consent is a book that was written about the same material when I had the wisdom to know not only what life brings you, but as someone who's taught for years and who's read for years, I can see the stinginess in young people's writing. And I didn't, you know, and the kind of generosity in older people's writing. And I wanted that.
Yeah, I think that's a confidence that comes with age. I am a much
Let's
more...
hope.
Yeah. You also share endearing stories, though, about how Arnold in the 1980s held the hand of a longtime friend who had AIDS and had been banned from a public pool, demanding that they be let in, jumping into the water together, and that you never loved him more. It's, you didn't shy away from the good, the bad, the complicated.
He was all of it, all right? He was probably, he definitely did something wrong when he stepped over the line with me because I was underage. So there's no question that that was wrong. He was also a generous. He was a feminist. He was a progressive. He was a wonderful man. And so that's the other thing that I hope consent brings to people. The idea that human beings are complex. They're both awful and wonderful. And one doesn't negate the other.
And it's his painting on the cover of this book.
Yes, it is. He was a magnificent painter. And that was a painting that he did of me. He took a photo of me when I was 17. He probably did the painting a few years later. And I have my eyes closed. And you can't not look at that painting and ask. It has many things. That painting has many aspects of it that talk about both his love of me, but why are my eyes closed? And that's kind of the question that I wanted consent to answer. Are they closed in trust? Yes. And are they closed because I don't want to see something? Yes.
Do you ever wonder now that if you live another 20 years, maybe even another 30 years, that you might revisit this story again through a different lens?
Oh, I if I should live to 90 and I should have my brain and the world isn't covered in water and fire and I decide to rewrite this book, I was thinking, you know, I would, if I were to start it, I would begin with our old age, the part of when Arnold is old and I'm taking him to death, because I think as I move through the next 20 years of my life, if I'm that lucky, I will understand what he went through. Like now I'm 71 and, you know, I'm losing energy just naturally. Okay. And when I was 41 and Arnold was 71, I would not accept that he was losing energy. And I was impatient that he was losing energy. And I would find it very interesting to go through the last 20 years of our lives. Now that I've experienced or will experience what he went through, and understand that relationship, which I still don't understand. And that would be really interesting to do. So let's hope I still have my brain.
Yeah, the in some way, and I don't know if this is an inappropriate association, you know, becoming a parent made me appreciate all the effort that my mother put into raising me in ways I couldn't until I became a parent. And
absolutely.
I wonder if it'll make you, I don't know, appreciate all the effort he put into running around the world with somebody 3 decades his junior.
I just recently I was in New York and I used to, when we'd get to New York, I'd throw down my suitcase. I'd say, let's go take a 2-hour walk. And he'd say, oh honey, I'd like to lay down for a while. I'd say, come on, let's enjoy life. And the last time I was in New York, I got to the apartment and I threw down my suitcases and I laid down. And I thought, oh my God, am I wanting him to take a walk now? So I think it would be really actually very interesting to do that.
That's Jill Cement, the author of the new memoir, Consent. Coming up, we're going to explore the importance of language and the ever-changing language that we use to describe relationships in society. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from The Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour with the author of a new memoir, Consent, that reexamines a relationship between an art teacher and a student, a marriage that lasted nearly 5 decades. Still with us is author Jill Cement. In your first memoir, the story ends at a certain point with Arnold, but in this memoir, we see him to the end of his life and how that relationship evolved along with your career. And I want to go back to you graduated college and decided to pursue writing instead of painting. And I have to wonder, how do you go to school for painting, graduate and say, I think I'd rather do writing?
You know, it's one of the enigmas of my life. Like, why? I was really good at painting, okay? I was doing conceptual art, but it was something that was natural. Writing was very unnatural to me. I was dyslexic. I couldn't spell. I probably didn't write anything until I decided to become a writer.
Your mother says you don't know how to spell cat at that point.
I didn't even write a letter. I mean, I just didn't write. Whenever I had a project in high school that I had to do, I would find a way to make a painting for it instead, okay? It was just, I was that kid who couldn't write. I read voraciously, so it's not that I couldn't read. It was just that when I would take a pencil, and this is probably true of every dyslexic kid, you know, when I wrote in mirror image with, I just couldn't do it, which is kind of astonishing since I could take a pencil and draw you exactly, okay? It was as if when I tried to imitate letters, they just didn't come. And one of the, you know, the great things is Arnold got me a typewriter. And once I learned to type, I would remember the, not by T-H-E, but where my fingers went on the typewriter.
I love
so
that.
That's how I remembered phone numbers, by patterns. And so soon as language became a finger pattern, like playing the piano, my dyslexia vanished about 90%. And I mean, I still couldn't spell, but you know, it wasn't important. As I got to write more, I started to understand grammar. But first I had to break from that idea of handwriting, because I think handwriting is a huge problem for dyslexic people. Now, what I did, honestly, is when I dropped out of graduate school, like, I don't know, 10 weeks before I was going to get my degree to prove that I wasn't going to be an artist. Only a lunatic would do that, but I was young and a lunatic. And then Arnold bought me the Norton Critical Editions. These were books that they had an edition of all, you know, books that were important, and they had all the criticism in the back. We got a used, huge, like 10 boxes of this stuff. And I spent like 3 years reading through, and every day I would practice making sentences. And when I was done and I felt like I had the history of literature under my belt and I knew how to make a sentence, I started to write. What possessed me to do this is, again, the enigma of my life. But it was something I was really drawn to do.
And Arnold seems completely in your corner. He edits for you. He reads your work. He obviously provides you the home and the space within which to struggle through this.
Yeah, and the support. I mean, again, first, I want, you know, to make it to show the equality of our relationship. I did the same thing to his paintings. I would storm into his studio. I'd say, that's a stupid idea. I'd pick up a paintbrush and repaint, okay? And he would do the same thing with my work. It was a very collaborative marriage.
That takes a lot of, like, a foundation. It takes a really stable foundation to critique each other's life's work.
Yeah, it, and it was part of you know, the dynamics of our marriage. And it's interesting. I have a new partner now, and I wouldn't show him my work at the beginning at all because I don't want that relationship ever again. But while I had it, it was extraordinary. And having Arnold as a painter allowed me to remain in the visual art world for my whole life, which I think I would have been bereft if I hadn't been.
I also think there's something, I don't know what the right word is. I've thought about the word drug or addicting or heady about an older man who's accomplished praising the work that you're doing as a young woman.
That's how all young women get in trouble because it is a heady idea. I mean, had I been with a young man who was still finding himself and he said, "Oh, you could be a great writer," I would look at him and think, "You haven't figured yourself out. I'm not going to believe you." But when you're with an older man or an older woman, you believe them in a way that you just don't with your own contemporary peers. And so I think that's why young people get in trouble with old people because that's what they want.
Yeah.
And, you know, old people will probably take advantage of that, but in the same time, it's also an exchange.
Yeah, I have been thinking about that a lot since reading Consent because so I was always a nerdy kid. I was on my debate team in high school, was
Good
super
for
not
you.
popular. Yeah. But I loved to write. I loved history. In particular, I loved politics. I always say politics was my first love. And my sophomore year of high school, I had a history teacher who loved these things too, who he was the first person that I can remember who directly encouraged my writing, who talked politics to me like an adult, right? We would talk about the current events. He would encourage me in my writing. And I want to be clear, he never indicated any kind of romantic ink, not even like a whiff of attraction to me in that way. But I had the biggest raging crush on that man. And I think back on that and I'm just like, I think it was because he was the first person who spoke to me like who wasn't in my family, who wasn't my mother or my father, who spoke to me like I was an adult, an
Yeah,
intelligent human being, like I was worthy of respect in my own right, my own thoughts.
and the idea of having someone listen to you outside of your family. I mean, when your family assigns you to a role. So whatever you say, they see it in that role. But to walk out into the world and have an adult pay attention to you, I mean, that's why teachers shouldn't sleep with their students because the student wants that attention so badly that they are vulnerable. I mean, it's more of a vulnerability of intellect than it is of sexuality in many ways.
Yeah, I've been thinking about it a lot because he never ever indicated, as far as I know, it was very much a like mentorship. Like he was trying to be a good teacher, right? And he saw a spark and he wanted to encourage it to flourish. But if
But
he,
had he whispered in your ear, "I
that is
wish
the
you were older,"
question. Yes. And
you might have fallen for it.
that's what I come back to. And I sort of wonder if consent is at his essence, and what we talk about when we use the word grooming today, and I think it gets misused in the media
I
all the
agree.
time. But when we talk about grooming, I wonder at its core, is it an adult creating the illusion of consent in a minor?
Well, I mean, again, grooming is, I mean, in my book, there's another story, and it's the story of my brother's molestation. And my brother was molested by a neighbor. And I put that story in, obviously, with his permission, because I wanted to show the difference, okay, between a pederast going after a child. But I also put it in because I wanted to show the vulnerability of fatherless children. I mean, my brother was looking for an older man to love him, no more or less than I was. And that's what made him so vulnerable. I think that I think it's an iffy relationship. It's also a relationship. I mean, would I have questioned the whole thing if I had been 21? Then it wouldn't be in that kind of blurry zone. But, you know, by the time I was 16, I'd been working in the world for 3 or 4 years. I earned my own money. I was not the average teenager. So I don't know, I was primed for it. What can I say?
Yeah, you have this really poignant line where you say that there's this scene where you say that you gave up your bedroom, you converted into a painting studio, and then you sleep in bed with your mother. You sleep in the spot where your father had slept until he left. And it's such, I mean, just the imagery of sleeping in the spot where your father used to sleep while beginning this relationship with Arnold. It was such a powerful image in the book.
And I left it out of Half a Life, and you think to yourself, what a great image. Why would I have left that out? I don't think I left it out to be obscure or to lessen something. I think I left it out because when you're trying to control a book, I mean, you've got so many things you're trying to, it's like juggling with 100 plates, okay, and spinning plates and balls, that to just get through it, you don't think about all those nuances. Or maybe I left it out because I didn't want to talk about what I thought was so obvious, that I wanted a father.
I do wonder, how do you look back on the 45 years that you were together? This is one of the things that I think you try to confront in Consent, is this all fruit of the poisonous tree?
It is. It is all fruit of the poisonous tree. Had he not kissed me, would I have had the guts to go seduce him? I don't know. At the same time, so what if it's fruit of the poisonous tree? It was a great marriage. What are you supposed to do when you have had a good experience that is supposed to be considered a bad thing? And, you know, I believe my marriage brought more good into the world. I mean, you know, I was, you know, my husband and I were an example for so many people of what a happy marriage can be. I guess what Consent is trying to say at its very heart is that the world is really complex, and that truths can negate each other and there's still truths.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that drew me to the book, is that it's so hard to decide how I feel about it. And I love that in fiction. I love that in nonfiction. I love those books that you can't stop thinking about because you can't draw a clear conclusion.
And I can't draw a clear conclusion, and I lived it. And I think that idea that we can't draw a clear conclusion is, if it would inform all of our lives, I think we'd be more generous people.
I was a little worried, to be honest, about doing this hour, just in the kind of reaction. And I think, you know, all sides should be all sides, but it's controversial to talk about relationships that begin this way, particularly in this day and age. What has been the reaction from friends, from students, from colleagues to re-examining your relationship in this new light?
I can say that everyone who knew Arnold and I have found it to be an homage to him. And people who didn't know us, I mean, you know, when the report in the article in the New York Times came out, there are thousands of comments. Each one, first of all, no one had, when they made those comments, no one had actually read the book, that are so...
I feel that as a journalist, like the comments without reading the article.
Right. And, you know, so I didn't read them, but my partner read them. And, you know, they're the opposite of what my friends thought. So I've experienced both things. I think going public with anything that isn't black and white really evokes a tremendous discussion, but I'm really happy the discussion, and I'm thrilled that my book, you know, raised those questions and entered the zeitgeist of what we consider an appropriate relationship.
How did you land on consent as a title? Because I don't think that was a word that you would have had at 17.
I didn't. First of all, consent meant something so different. I mean, I went through a million titles. Its working title was The Other Half. But then I realized they'd have to have read the first half, and that seemed crazy. And I tried a million titles. One was The Younger Woman, and I finally, when I landed on consent, it seemed like the most direct word in which you can see, you can, consent is such a word that it's ambiguous, and it's a word that has so many different meanings. And it's, you know, was I capable of consent at 16 and 17? And that's, I guess, what the book is about.
That was writer and author Jill Cement. Her new memoir, Consent, is out now. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you so much.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.